Good evening. You're listening to Let's Go Green here on Midlands 103. On this show, each and every Monday evening, we try and tackle issues around the environment, everything from last week's special on food waste to fast fashion and so much more. And if you're involved in green issues, if your work is around tackling climate change, please do make sure and get in touch with me through the midlands103.com website or by email letsgogreen@midlands103.com. Now, we are this evening joined by someone who you might think is an unusual guest for an environmental show, and he is, he's basically a Midlands 103's resident Garda, but Sergeant Graeme Kavanagh, Crime Prevention Officer for Laois and Offaly. You are very welcome to Let's Go Green this evening.
Thanks, Aisling. Unusual is a word I hear about myself all the time. So,
so Graeme, why am I speaking to you on an environmental show? Where does that issue come into the play when it comes to your job?
Okay, so people typically think as crime prevention officers that we're you constantly hear us reminding you not to be leaving stuff in cars or to lock your home and that sort of stuff. But one piece of work, and it's probably a huge piece of work we don't really get involved too much in and we'd love to be involved in, is the whole area of environmental design. So if you have an area that's designed right and you've all people involved in at the pre-design stage, you can effectively try and design out, say, the antisocial behaviour element. You can design out crime as best you can. You can't really design out the human factor, because if people are going to be bad, they're going to be bad. But if you can make a place that they're proud to live in and they actually take care of it themselves, then ultimately what you're looking at trying to do is making the place more environmentally pleasing. If you can reduce the amount of response by ourselves, for example, our local authorities calling out to collect rubbish or to clean up after that sort of antisocial behaviour, that's a green win. That means that people are looking after the location themselves, maintaining it right. And yeah, people think that's a bit aspirational, but it does work. You know, this piece, it's a thing called crime prevention through environmental design. And there's a piece that our colleagues in the UK have about safer places. And there's certain attributes that you look for to try and make a community a better place to live in. And you can't achieve it all, but if you can achieve the bulk of it, you make a place safer to live in. People are happier to live in it. You're increasing people's enjoyment of the area. It would probably, if you're living, say, for example, you picture yourself living in, with a back laneway at the house or a side laneway, you can see the antisocial behaviour is going to affect mental health. So if you can discourage that or remove that, that increases people's, I suppose, mental well-being.
So as you're speaking there, I'm thinking about, I did my master's in London at a place in London called Elephant and Castle. Yeah. And it was the college building was effectively on a large junction where the pedestrian walkways all went under the main road. And as I was doing my master's, that had been there since my dad was working on the buildings in London back in the 80s. It had been a problem for decades. And I remember at the time there was talk around the council trying to change the road layout, because there was a feeling that these pedestrian walkways that went under the road were so well hidden that then as a result, people were being mugged, or there might have been drug problems or homelessness issues. So is this what you're talking about? That when, say, a major public project is in the design phase, that somebody with your expertise would come along and look at it and think, yeah, lads, that looks really pretty, but you might be leaving yourself open to, well, this could be antisocial, this could be a drug issue. You know, that somebody with your knowledge coming in at the design phase.
Exactly. And it's not, again, it's not a criticism of anything. It's just another set of eyes to look at and say, like, as a police officer or as a CIPTED practitioner, this is what I see. If we do it this way, this is the problem you're going to have. So what you're talking about there is one of the attributes is access and movement. So people can have defined routes or spaces where they feel safe. But if we design it, if you don't design it right, if you think of the unintended consequences, that them routes then become, if they're overtaken by the criminal elements, they become unsafe places. So a thing called permeability, that if we give people the right to walk through an area and they've a lawful right to do it, then inevitably what happens, one of two things happens. The place becomes a safe place. People will use it, or the criminal side of the antisocial behaviour side overtakes it, and then the right-minded person doesn't use it anymore because they're afraid to do it, you know. So sometimes they, in all designs you see in the 70s and 80s, you'd have separate cycleways and pathways, people, different purposes, you know, where now we're trying to move. You see all our cycleways are beside the footpath. Mm-hmm. There's people moving by. It's safer that way. The underpass is not a great idea. Back laneways, you'd see on houses. I remember my time in the city, we had back laneways, the backs of houses. It was a real thing that was done in the 70s when they built houses. And inevitably, you look down them, broken glass, graffiti on walls. People didn't use them anymore. You'd see a lot of the walls brocked up. People didn't feel safe to do it, you know. And in time, what happened was, the local authority then would maybe subsume that laneway into the land or into the person's property. Or there was a great example up in Belfast there over the pandemic, where them sort of little alleyways, they call it gated alleyways, they suddenly became community gardens. So no longer were people using them for the wrong reasons. People actually started using them as part of their back garden. You could still walk through, but you had to go through gates to get through. So only the people living in that area could access that area. So suddenly you were taking that, I suppose, permeability side that the criminal would use or the person that's up to no good would use, only the people that live in the area could access it. So it's not a fortress, it's just giving the people that are entitled to be there the right to be there.
Now I know, and as you mentioned, we saw like areas like that, and I can't quite remember the location, being on the news during lockdown, where people were using them as social gathering spaces, those little alleyways behind houses. Now I'm going to ask a really boring and practical question. If you close those places off to gates and that, how do you get your bins out? Because, and I asked that because I know from living in Dublin, where like I ended up having a situation where I didn't have a back alley. I remember one house I was renting in particular, beautiful house, but we had to have the bins at the front door because that was the only place for them. And I hated it because you had to walk past them every time you entered and exited the house. You got the smell of the bins, because even though as clean as possible you tried to be, especially in the summer, there's always going to be some kind of a whiff, and it's just an eyesore.
It is, and it's, I suppose that's where we come into it, like at the design stage now, or the pre-design, when you're building new houses, that you have, if you're going to build, say, bin storage facilities, that you're building them in a safe way, that they're not going to become hotspots for antisocial behaviour, or you're not leaving them open that people burn the rubbish, or people can do stuff like that, you know. So sometimes we see them, sometimes we see, I suppose I pass through developments, I have no involvement in it, but I'd look and I, it's not that I'm picking fault, I'm just seeing there's a slight issue now that in time that might become an issue, you know. If you've noticed, so like a lot of the corporation houses built in the city, like in Dublin back in the day, they wouldn't have a side passage. They had the backyard. That was for people bringing in, I suppose, a lot of fuel to burn and stuff like that. You can still do that. But what you're doing is you're trying to if you don't take over the laneway and subsume into people's gardens, that you try and restrict the access into it for people so that they can pull the bin out to a collection point, or that they have the facilities in an area. So you see some new developments. I see them around town there in Tullamore, that they've a place to put the bin that's safe and secure, and they can come and take it out.
And on that, because I encountered somebody in the development where I live using our bins when he had nothing to do with the area. And the language that was shouted at me was quite interesting on Monday mornings. But, you know, I give as good as I get. But like that, in communal areas where, say, the bin is just like, and in my development, the bin is open to the public. There's no gate. There's nothing like that. Like, are we talking that you might have a crime prevention officer or a qualified person involved, even in developments of, well, housing, like not just like, I'm thinking maybe like it might seem like an obvious thing to say the development of O'Connor Square in Tullamore, a big public project. But would you also extend this idea into the development of housing and apartment complexes?
Yeah, so typically, say, my colleagues in the UK do this quite a lot. They're called designing of crime officers. They do a lot of the work that we do, but predominantly this is what they're involved in. So hospitals, schools, apartments, shared housing, public spaces, all the areas you're talking about, anywhere. It doesn't matter if it's a house estate of 500 houses or a housing estate of 38 houses. All we're looking for is we have a look at a set of drawings. we see, well, that's actually all right, because there mightn't be anything wrong at all with what you're designing. But all it is a set of eyes and ears to say, well, hold on, you're building this here. I'm looking at the crime profile for the area in general. This is what we see. If you do this, that this might lead to this problem. So maybe we'll be this way. You eliminate that problem, you know. So, yeah, and a lot of the stuff we do in Ireland is about the physical protection. So, you know, the way you hear me talking about locking your windows, locking your doors, yeah, all this sort of stuff. A lot of the time, we see some of our burglaries taking place where the locks wouldn't be great. So we're talking about when you're designing a place that, yes, it might be cheaper to put cheap locks in the doors now, but that €2 or €3 extra to spend on the locks might actually deter or prevent burglaries in time, you know, or mm-hmm. good quality windows and doors, or lighting in the area, good public lighting in the area, all physical protection that will help. And like this, believe it or not, for all the stuff I talk about, there's standards for all of them, whether they're UK or European standards, the standards. And somebody has spent time trying to design these sort of things that will stop what you were talking about, somebody being able to access the bins for a communal area, discard the rubbish in them, that only the people that are entitled to be there can do that. You know?
Okay, I'm thinking about, just as you were saying there about the locks, I used to have a neighbour, a couple who were originally from the Philippines. And I remember at one stage, within the space of a weekend, we both locked ourselves out of our respective homes. Right. Yeah. Basically, within the space of 48 hours. And she was telling me that in the Philippines, that in the area of the Philippines where she is from, that because they're so conscious of crime, that a standard lock like we would have here in Ireland with a key, an actual physical key, they just don't do it anymore. It's all electronic, for that very reason, that they're super secure locks on the main entrances. And that sounds fantastic. And out of pure curiosity, I looked it up. Some of these things are expensive.
Yeah.
And not everybody will be able to afford them. And they won't be able to be included in whatever budget it is, whether it's a public project or a private project. So I suppose, where then do you, does it come down to you cut your cloth to fit your measure? Like you just, you do what you can afford?
Yeah, you don't need to be spending huge money. I mean, you go to any of your reputable locksmiths and look for a lock. It's a TS007, a Euro profile cylinder lock. And they're anti-snap, anti-bump, anti-drill locks. So some of the locks we see, people come up and snap them off and they've accessed them to the lock and mess it, and they can open the door. Some of the burglaries I'm seeing, they're breaking the glass, you know. Yeah, I mean, that's really the real drastic element. But again, the standards for windows and doors past 24/2016 is a standard that we refer to quite a lot. It's a UK standard for the windows and doors, and they're all built to resist a certain level of criminal attack, you know. But these IP locks, the digital locks, or whatever way you want to refer to them, they're just as good, but you don't need to be doing that. I mean, you can buy a good physical lock or get your locksmith to install it. Other things then, the likes of, like, I grew up in big urban areas and you see big, vast housing estates, you know, and people have the right to go through the area. And one thing we always talk about is cul-de-sacs. A cul-de-sac is actually a safe area because unless there's a laneway at the end of that cul-de-sac that allows somebody to walk through into another area, generally there's eyes and ears, people can see. So people are less likely to go into that area to cause problems.
Okay. Okay.
Where if you've got permeability, that right to be able to go through, then you have a legitimate reason to be going through. But you could be up to no good, you know. Okay. So always trying to get people to think, like looking at drawings, looking for the likes of that to see, right, is there a reason, do we need to have that walkway going through that area? I mean, I remember one of the developments in the town here that I cover, and a laneway in the estate, there was no real reason for it being there, only that it was a piece of land and it was to give people a shortcut through. But who do you think used it?
Yeah.
It was evening time, night time, dark evenings, bad lighting, and suddenly it became a hotspot to be found to social behaviour. So simple enough things was improving the lighting in the area, you know. Sometimes I'd see, say, electrical or junction boxes being built at the side of walls. Suddenly it's a climbing aid down over into somebody's back garden. Windows are, see some apartment blocks that there could be buildings built to the side of the apartment block, and suddenly there's a climbing aid up onto that, and then you're up onto the balcony of an apartment. It's all unintended consequences, you know. So again, you're trying to pick up on them sort of things, and all you're trying to do is reduce the risks for the people that are ultimately going to live there.
Well, we are joined by Sergeant Graham Kavanagh, who is Crime Prevention Officer for Laois and Offaly this evening. And we're discussing this idea of embedding the Gardaí's expertise into the design of projects, whether it be a public space or housing or retail developments. And we thought it'd be an interesting conversation to be having this evening on our environmental show, because, you know, what we include on these plans ultimately leads to how we live our lives and what the environment feels like. So we're going to take a short break now, and we'll be back in a few moments time. You're listening to Let's Go Green here on Midlands 103. And this evening we are talking crime prevention through design. To discuss this a little bit further, we are joined by Crime Prevention Officer Sergeant Graham Kavanagh, who operates in the Laois Offaly district. Now, Graham, I think we've got a good overall picture of what this idea is just before the break. But I know, like, as you mentioned early on, like, this is not... This idea of embedding the expertise of yourself and your colleagues in the Gardaí in the design phase of any big project, it's not a new thing. It's been tried, tested and even improved in other parts of the world. So can you maybe give us some idea of the things that you would be looking for if you were asked to assess, say, a new project for the Midlands?
Okay, so first of all, you're right, this isn't new, so I'm not going to pretend that this is stuff that I'm making up. It's out mm-hmm. there, you know. The Home Office in the UK brought up a piece about the attributes of sustainable communities, so it makes them safer places. So they looked at areas like access and movement, the structures, surveillance, the ownership, physical protection, activity, and management and maintenance. Now, the sound, what does all that mean, you know? But when you break it down, it's pretty simple stuff. The access and movement is what we spoke about before the break, about what routes you create. Do you create too much access for people that might be up to no good? And you do it without compromising security for people that live in the area. And people think, when they think security, they're thinking about it's just the locks, alarms and CCTV. Security is a sense of being. Do you feel safe? Do you feel secure in your community? The structure, places that are structured so that different uses do not cause conflict. So if you build a playground, for example, in a housing estate, is that going to attract antisocial behaviour in the evening time? Or if you create a walkway through at the back of the estate, is that going to give people up to no good a right to be passing through the area, being able to look into back gardens to see what access is there? Surveillance. So people think surveillance. The first thing you're going to think of when I say surveillance is probably CCTV.
Mm-hmm. And the Absolutely.
And the best form of surveillance is us, eyes and ears, people seeing and hearing things, you know. So it's... where places are publicly accessible, that the spaces are always overlooked. So there's buildings, people are overlooking it, you know. Go back to the pandemic, the last 2 years. Mm-hmm. We can't say the burglary stopped, but they dropped off because we were at home. We were able to see things. Criminals knew we were at home, so there was surveillance there. Less likely to try things. We're starting to see it increase again because people are going back to work, moving out about again. Ownership is always a piece. They promote a sense of ownership, respect, territorial responsibility and community. So that's an important piece. I see there Tidy Towns are back active again. There was a lot of work in Tullamore over the weekend, and there was work over in Port Laois as well. And that's the sort of stuff people take pride of place in it. And don't believe it or not, even the one that's up to no good, if they feel that this place is a place to be proud of and nice to live in, they'll actually take ownership and they'll start looking after their own little area. Not going to look after everywhere else, you know, but the lack of, you know, saying that, I know what you're going to say, and I'm thinking there's always going to be the small element that doesn't, you know, but you're never going to get rid of all the problems, you know, but that's where the shared ownership. So if people see that, more likely to report it, and that they see that something happens and something, say, the authorities or whoever it is, takes responsibility for that and deals with them individuals, that's the deterrent in themselves. So that could be ourselves or the local authority.
So playing devil's advocate, does this mean that we don't include playgrounds in housing estates?
No.
That they're just a no-go area?
No, it's putting them in the right place.
Okay.
So typically when I look at, say, a good design, the playground, Say you pick it, you drive into a housing estate and you have houses around the four aspects and there's a green area in the middle. That's where the playground is. It's not stuck up in the corner away from where people can see, which sometimes you see, you know.
Yeah, you do, definitely. Sometimes you see that when perhaps the playground has been added in after the development, like years after. Okay.
Yes.
And then I suppose continuing on with this devil's advocate train of questioning.
Yeah.
If we were to include, if say, for instance, you had a Garda somehow involved in with the local planning office in every county council, who would pay for it? Where would this be an added expense?
No, it's a free service. So that's what we do. It's our job. OK, the added expense probably comes in sometimes to do things properly. You have to spend that bit more money to do it at the design stage. But this is the point we always make. It might be cheaper to do it now at the pre-design stage than to do it retrospectively when the problem arises down the road. So that's always the balance, you know. Yes, to do things right will cost money. But then again, it mightn't be a whole lot, you know. It might be getting rid of that laneway at the back of the house. Is there a need for that? Why are we putting that there? And maybe include that in people's back gardens. Or if you're going to do it there, that you've good lighting along that way, that you've good landscaping. This landscaping itself can be a physical protection. That's one area we're going to talk about next. It could be thorny hedges, that sort of stuff that deters somebody from getting over a wall into somebody's back garden. So when our role isn't to say, no, you can't do that. Our role is not to object to stuff. Our role is just to say, right, I've looked at these. I've picked up on the following things. There's a gable end house. You know what? Maybe you need to put a window in that rather than just a sheer wall where nobody can see out, you know. Or if it's in a laneway, I wouldn't be putting that window at the bottom on the ground floor of the window, because now suddenly somebody can walk down that laneway and they can see in the window, or it's a point to break in. Or it could be sometimes you see with housing that the gates, say a side gate, could be way down the passageway. Mm-hmm. And you're bringing that further up to the front of the passage, the side passage, because so if you put it halfway down or further down, somebody can walk down there, dark evening, can't be seen. Where if you bring the gate further up, then it meets the corner of the house, it's secure.
And then, okay, and that makes a lot of sense. So, it does seem very practical. Now, I suppose the reason I'm hesitating is because I know how difficult it is to get planning permission for anything in this country. Yeah. And if you start saying that for crime prevention reasons, that really Aisling O'Rourke should have a window in the gable end of her house that looks in on Graham Kavanagh's back garden.
Yes.
I'm expecting there to be serial objections to the project. And I know there would be. So I suppose where do you find the balance then?
Yeah. And that's something that security can never overcome privacy, you know. That's one thing you're always conscious of when you're looking at this, that you don't want to be causing conflict down the road. So you're really looking very deeply into, right, if I turn the aspect of this house to look that way, well, what's it going to see, you know? So all you're doing is offering guidance. It's not like conditions of planning or anything like that, you know?
Okay.
That's the really important piece. It's a guidance and advice. I'd never be involved in the one-off design of a house. You're looking at developments, you know? So really, say for a school or a new hospital, for example, your objective is to try and make that place safe for the people that work there, the people that attend there, and the people that come and visit the place. So typically, cars could be the problem. You're making sure that nobody can enter the premises of the hospital and get into the wrong areas, you know, so it's access control is a big thing. But yeah, I know what you're thinking, that suddenly that our advice would mean that you could cause conflict between neighbours. No, that's not what you're trying to do. You're trying to do, the other way is trying to reduce that happening.
Okay. And then you mentioned there, and I'm afraid we are coming close to time, but this idea then that if you're going to put a hedge around the house, that it should be one that, how do I put this politely, that I suppose we wouldn't want to be thrown into, that it might do a bit of harm, that there might be an actual foliage type barrier to the house?
Defensible planting is the fancy term for it, so thorny hedges. That's the word you're looking for. One other thing, okay, and I know I'm just jumping onto something else. Management maintenance is one thing. We see quite a lot of car parks around it. Think of a car park. Just pick a car park. It looks great during the day. Would you use that at night time?
Yeah.
Would you go in at 2 o'clock in the morning? Is it badly lit? Underground car parks. Like, one of the roles that we have is a lot of us as crime prevention officers were qualified car park assessors. So we look at a car park to try and make that place a safer place for people to use, no matter what time of the day or night it is. And we've done a bit of work with Irish Rail on this, you know, to make these places safer, that people feel safe to park there, morning, noon and night that they can come in, that the lighting is good. Lighting is always a great deterrent. You know, people can see before they go into the car park. You can see around. You're in your car before you get out, that you can see around, you know, and that people can't come in and feel that they can break into cars or steal catalytic converters for them, you know. So you're trying to design that. And even going on to catalytic converters, the unintended consequences of the design of them was that suddenly you had high metal value in it and they were going to eventually be stolen. It was the unintended consequence to put a high metal values in it, you know. So we never get involved in the design element of that. But like if somebody had asked us 20 years ago, we're going to design a device that's going to suck the fuel or the particulates out of the diesel or the petrol, but we're going to put high precious metals in it, probably would have said, yeah, chances are they might be stolen. You know, so we design them with the security side in it, which we're only getting around to doing now, you know, retrospectively making them more secure.
Well, Sergeant Graham Kavanagh, a crime prevention officer for Laois and Offaly, thank you so much for joining me on the show this evening. I've certainly learned a lot. It's been a fascinating conversation and one that I suspect we will be coming back to in the not too distant future. Thank you so much for your time.
Thanks, Ashley.
I'll be back after the break. You're listening to Let's Go Green here on Midlands 103. I hope you have been enjoying our conversations here this evening. So what do you think? Should Gardaí be involved at the pre-design phase of major public projects and any kind of infrastructure to try and share their expertise when it comes to crime prevention? After all, it does impact on the quality of life that we all live and indeed the environment that surrounds us. I think it's a fascinating idea and one that I wasn't aware of before starting this programme. So I do hope that you found the conversation with Laois Offaly Crime Prevention Officer Sergeant Graham Kavanagh there. Well, you make sure and get in contact with me through midlands103.com or indeed directly by email at letsgogreen@midlands103.com. We're going to take a musical interlude here now, and you know how much I enjoy promoting Irish artists and Irish musicians, and this one, Lyra's Light Me Up, landed on YouTube on St. Patrick's Day this year. And if you've not seen the video on YouTube, I would really suggest that you go and look it up. It's absolutely beautiful. Not only is the song stunning, but just the whole story behind it is one that is very interesting to watch. So here it is, Lyra and Light Me Up. You're listening to Let's Go Green here on Midlands 103, and I hope you've been enjoying the show this evening. Well, you may have noticed, in fact, you probably have noticed, unless you're living under a rock, but fuel prices have skyrocketed recently, and it's brought the conversation back to our motor vehicles and what could we do that might be a bit better for the environment, but also a bit better for our pocket. And who better to have this conversation with only a Bob Flavin, Midlands 103's resident motoring journalist at this stage. Bob, thanks for joining us this evening.
What a lovely intro. Thank you very much.
Now, Bob, I went down the hybrid route last year because I didn't have the confidence in the infrastructure to go completely electric. But I know it's a conversation that people are having at the moment, because with the price of fuel, both petrol and diesel going up and up and up, it's brought this conversation, the idea that we could just plug in the car at home has really come to the fore. And I'm wondering, you know, people might feel a bit daunted about even entertaining the idea. Where would you start if you were somebody who was looking to even consider moving over to electric?
Where I'd start every time is with your annual mileage. Okay, so the average car park in Ireland is about 9 years old. So the cars we're all driving, the regular, normal, we'll say people who aren't wealthy enough to have a brand new car, are probably driving something that's 5 to 9 years old. Now, that means they're subject to NCT, which means your NCT records your mileage every single year. So if you look at the NCT or every 2 years, depending on the age of your car, if you look at the mileage in your NCT, you'll figure out very quickly what your average mileage is over 2 years. So that will answer your question immediately as to how many miles, because a lot of people think they drive very far when in actual fact, they don't really drive that far at all. Some people are doing 10,000 kilometers a year, but if you ask them, they tell you, oh no, it must be 30,000 kilometers. It feels like, because they're hours in their car in traffic or they're hours in their car commuting to a place, but actually it's not that far in actual kilometers. So any of those kind of short range drivers could do that. The other one to look at is what is your average daily journey. So if you're going to and from the shops, you're dropping the kids to school, you're tipping off to work, you're zooming out for lunch, you might go out on a Sunday, you might go to the gym in the afternoon, your total daily mileage might be 30 or 40 kilometers. That's the EU average, 40 kilometers. And the EU average, and even the Irish average, for a car to be standing still per day is 18 hours. So a car that actually just stands still outside of a door, whether it's work, home, the gym, wherever it is, the pool or something you're going to in the evening, it just stands still when it gets you there. So that's about 18 hours a day. So if you think of 18 hours and your average journey is 30 kilometers and your average mileage is 10,000 kilometers, there isn't a single electric car that couldn't achieve that in the market easily.
That's a really nifty tip there about the NCT cert, because I know, or at least we're all supposed to keep a copy of the NCT cert for when we want to trade in the car or sell it on. So, you know, if we just go into whatever cupboard it's filed in at home, look at those, we get the actual facts of the situation as opposed to what we think we do in a given year. So that's something I certainly haven't considered myself before. But talk to me then about like the charger. So one of the things that maybe from my own perspective, where I live, it's an apartment block, it's run by a management company. If I were to get an electric car and have to get some kind of charging system installed, to be honest, I wouldn't even know where to start. And I'm wondering, like, are there even any grants available? Like, how does it all work?
Yeah, there is a grant available. It's about half the price of the charger. So the charger usually is booked. Look, dealers are supposed to put you on to the right person to help you with the charger, right? 9 times out of 10, a dealer just wants you to go away with the car. Just buy the car and get out. My deal is finished. The dealer doesn't have time. They've got more deals to be doing. They don't make a whole lot of money out of the charger end of it or the electricity end of it. That's not their problem. It is kind of a problem because they're the only port to call. Just remember, young people who are going to buy a car would have went to mommy and daddy maybe, or brother and sister, and asked them what is the best car to buy. But mommy and daddy, brother and sister doesn't really know much about electric cars. So there isn't someone out there to kind of talk to other than the likes of me to come out and ask me questions about electric cars. So it's back to the journalists again. But realistically, even if you Google installers in the Midlands, you'll find a host of installers that install electric charge points. They can sort out the grant for you as well. So usually a charger costs about €1,200. You must be living in your own home. We currently don't have a charger for apartments. Apartments come with their own physical problems in that sometimes the fuse box is shared with another apartment next door to you. You don't get your own bill. Maybe the landlord gets the bill and then the landlord presents you with a bill later on. So all these things are a bit of an issue for putting in the apartment. Plus, you can't just put in a charge point. When you buy a house, you take out the charge point and bring it with you. You need to put in another charge point. So you lose the money you invest into that apartment block. So there's the problem with that part. That's a legislative thing. It's also a physical thing. We're kind of working on it, not working very fast on, but they are working. So the charger costs about £1,200 for a good one. You can get them down to maybe £900 if you start shopping about. You can buy these things on eBay. You can buy them on Amazon if you want to buy your own one, or you can get a proper, now you must, when you're installing it, get a proper qualified electrician to do this for you. Jimmy down the road will do it for sure. There's loads of guys out there who are selling themselves as their charger installers. But they're not. They're not even electricians. They're not even fully qualified to do it. And they may burn your house down. You just don't know. If you're going to mess with big, you're talking about a €60,000 car charging from a 3-pin plug outside the door. You don't want to mess with that. Okay. So get a proper qualified electrician. But the total install of probably about £1,200. Then half that is given back to you by the SEAI grant, which is about €600. But that comes retrospectively. So it comes after the charger's installed and you've bought the car.
So there's a lot to think about, particularly like if it's been a couple of years since you bought a car and now you're due to change. And, you know, this is going to be a bit of education before you get the car on the road. And like, it's a valid point that you say that the dealers aren't necessarily interested in that particular end of it. But I know when I went shopping myself last summer, I did the whole shop around. I went to dealers outside the Midlands, ended up shopping in the Midlands just for argument's sake. But one particular dealer I went into and I was looking, that brand had gone totally electric. I was like, okay, what's the deal with the charger? It's like, oh, I have no idea. And I was just, so I walked out the door. You know,
unfortunately, that's a story I hear a lot of.
Yeah.
Particularly from females. And I will say this in defense of females, and I'm very anti-sexism. But I work in an industry that is very heavily male dominated. And a lot of sales staff would still see a female walk in and assume that she knows nothing about the car or nothing about what she actually wants. There's a man somewhere going to make a decision for her. Where's your dad? I've heard these stories 100 times this year. dealers will have to figure this out. Women are quite independent and able to spend their own money and buy
and
their own cars.
And we have been for centuries. Like,
yes,
and that's, and the thing about it is, in that instance, I was seriously considering a car in that particular brand in that garage. And because they kind of just passed me off, you know, the several thousand I ended up spending went elsewhere. And like, they're losing out on money by not, in my perspective at least, by not having that information easily accessible. Like, surely at this stage of the game, you should go into any garage that's selling an electric vehicle, whatever kind of vehicle it is, and they have at least an SEAI stand with the grant information, leaflets on how the actual practicalities work. Like, I genuinely can't understand the gap.
It's a training issue. It's a sales speed issue. It's a target issue. So that it sells so many cars per month, and it's just they want to get the deals done. The future of dealerships, unfortunately for dealerships, is to be a lot smaller. There'll be a lot less of them. Realistically, people are buying cars online. If you go to buy a Tesla right now, today, if you go to buy a Polestar today, both those products are dealt with completely online. You don't have to go near a dealership. You don't have to go in and see any sales staff whatsoever. And everything's included, except for the charger. One else, only Tesla do the charger bit. But when it comes to buying your car, most people are very confident. They walk in with a lot of information. They've done a lot of research online. They're kind of aware of what car they're looking for. All they want to do is kind of tick a box. A lot of dealerships don't have any stock at the moment, so there's a lot less cars to buy right now. But unfortunately, dealer training and dealer going beyond the actual sale point, going beyond just selling you a car and supporting you from there on out, that does come with a drawback. For the dealership, they don't have time to do it. They're not paid to do it. But on the other end of the scale, they've got a customer just put over 50, 60,000 euros over the counter, and now they want to buy a charger as well. And that's where the dealer's starting to fall down between the cracks.
So if you are considering, and even if it's purely because of the cost of petrol and diesel and that the fact that they're becoming more financially unattractive to be driving those kind of motors, where do we go to find out this information? If we are expected to do basically all the research ourselves, are there reliable places to find out information like this?
I would only suggest going to journalists, going to proper, tried and trusted journalists and asking questions about them, because we're the only ones who are really asking questions of the dealerships. And we're asking environmental questions too. We're asking the environmental impact of these cars, these electric cars. And there is an environmental side to that, because they're not going to save the world. They're certainly going to clean the air, right? The air is going to get cleaner as they drive by because there's no tailpipe. But they're not a solution. Making new things is not environmentally friendly necessity. You know, we don't have to continue making stuff. The stuff you have right now could be kept on the road in your hybrid form and in battery form that would do a similar product over the next 5 to 10 years. Whereas we're all switching to this electric thing that we can't, this electric halo moment where we're all saying this is the best thing that ever happened to the environment. But really, we have to learn to recycle these things, dispose of them at the end of their life. Where are they going to end up on what scrap heap? When the battery comes out, what happens to it next? All those questions is what journalists are asking. So there's no one source still to say that they are the absolute be all and end all. There's a lot of vested interest. And I would suggest a lot of owners clubs and a lot of associations that are out there that proclaim to represent EV owners are actually, they've got skin in the game. A lot of them are dealerships. A lot of them sell products into that market. So it's not saying that you can't trust them. I'm not saying that you shouldn't join these, but you just got to take everything with a slight grain of salt, especially if anybody's selling something into it. That's why I say trust the journalists. Journalists have no skin in the game.
And of course, you can look up Bob Flavin on thenextgear.com. You're on Facebook and Instagram, I believe, Bob.
I'm on everywhere. I'm literally just Google me is the best way to do it. Is just put my name into Google because I appear all over the place, particularly on TikTok and YouTube, which would be the big one. My YouTube channel is fast approaching 75,000 subscribers. You should join them.
Fantastic, Bob. Well, listen, thank you so much. And I do apologize. We didn't have more time to have this conversation this evening, but perhaps we'll talk to you again in the not too distant future. So if you are looking at the price of petrol at the pump or the price of diesel, and you're thinking of maybe moving over to electric, take Bob's advice. Go to a trusted journalist and ask those questions, or even get onto Bob Flavin's YouTube channel. Bob, thanks so much for your time. That is all we have time for on this week's episode of Let's Go Green. My thanks to all my contributors. I hope you've enjoyed listening to the show. There will be no show next Monday evening because it's a bank holiday. It feels like we just had one, but we've got next Monday off, and I'll be back the week after next. So I hope you have a great long weekend. Stay safe and have a great week.